Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Saturday, February 15th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., it's the semi-annual KBOO Bluegrass Marathon.
Featuring 14 great local bands.
The Mavens.
Mountain Honey.
Sunfish Duo.
Annie Stanonets and John Cale.
Sunny South.
Martin Family Band.
Julie and the Waves.
Jack Straw.
Josh Cole and Friends.
The Sleepy Eye Johns.
Train River.
Lillian Sawyer.
The Hill Williams.
And the Filthy Skillets.
Wow, that's a lot of bluegrass.
Don't miss the Bluegrass Marathon on Saturday, February 15th.
From 9 to 6 on KBOO Portland.
Welcome to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon, and podcasting at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Our engineer today is Ty Walker. Good day, Ty. My name is Alon Robb, and I'm joined in the studio by Tori Bortman. Hello, Tori. How are you?
Good morning, Alon.
How are things with you?
Excellent. I'm glad to be here today.
So caucuses in Iowa and impeachments do not trouble you today?
Not right now.
That's
yeah,
good.
They do trouble me, but not this moment. I try to take breaks.
Good, because we have a wonderful show today, and the theme is building bicycles. In Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's beautiful story, The Little Prince, a pilot makes an emergency landing in the Sahara Desert. At sunrise, he is awakened by a small person asking him to draw a sheep. After a few attempts that are rejected, the frustrated pilot draws a box saying that the sheep is inside. The little prince is then satisfied. In today's show, we will not ask our guests to draw a sheep or even a bicycle, though drawing, designing, and building bicycles is something they have been doing well for quite a while. Our theme today is building bicycles. How does a bicycle emerge from drawings and dreams into a powerful machine sailing on roads and dirt paths? What is involved in building one from scratch? What is the future of this vehicle of transportation and transformation in the coming age of artificial intelligence and self-driving machines? To understand these questions and others, we will be joined by two cyclists and engineers who have devoted years to making better bikes and teaching the art and science involved. In the first half of the show, our guests will be Chase Spaulding, director of the Bicycle Design and Fabrication Program at Minnesota State College Southeast. In the second half of the hour, Brian Hanel, director of aftermarket engineering at the Trek Bicycle Corporation, will join us. Before we introduce our first guest, a few news items from the vast cycling universe.
The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, promises that every street in the city will be cycle-friendly by 2024. Seeking re-election, Mayor Hidalgo, a socialist and cyclist, plans to turn the French capital into a city where, in her words, you can find everything you need within 15 minutes of walking or biking from home, rather than driving to a suburban shopping mall. Aiming to help create an, quote, ecological transformation of the city, in her first term, In office, the mayor has initiated, quote, Plan Velo, which has been included removing car spaces and boosting spaces for cyclists and pedestrians. Mayor Hidalgo wants every street to have a cycle path and for all of the city's bridges, numbering over 300, to have protected cycleways. Wide and continuous main roads will be reserved for cycling, and 170 kilometers of uninterrupted and protected bicycle paths will exist. About 15% of this network has already been developed. The plan's cost is an estimated 250 million euro, which is the equivalent to the budget to build 7 kilometers of tramway or 2 kilometers of the metro. Under the new plans, Paris will also remove 72% of its 83,000 on-street car parking spaces, and key thoroughfares would be inaccessible to motor vehicles, while pedestrian plazas, green spaces, vegetable plots, and playgrounds will flourish. Less happy news comes from China, where many cities have come to a near standstill due to the coronavirus. In Wuhan, where the outbreak was first noted and where the spread of the disease has been most deadly, most residents remain in their homes. The streets have been eerily quiet and mostly free of cars, with many of the residents venturing out, choosing to walk or ride bicycles to do the shopping in the stores that are still open. The virus also has impacted manufacturing and shipping of bicycles and bicycle components and has led to the cancellation of bicycle trade shows and bicycle races across Asia. And back in the USA, mountain biking individuals and groups are beginning to organize in opposition to proposed oil and gas drilling under Moab Slick Rock Trail in the adjacent Sand Flats Recreation Area. As reported by BicycleRetailer.com, the Trump administration is pushing for drilling at this 16-kilometer trail over a landscape of petrified sand dunes and the eroded remnants of ancient seabeds. Regulations prohibit surface-level development in the area, but oil and gas could be extracted by directional drilling from adjacent land parcels a mile or more away. Designated wilderness areas in Arches National Park, as well as some land parcels held by State Educational Trust, surround the parcels. Ashley Cornelblatt, managing director of the Moab-based nonprofit Public Land Solutions and co-owner of a bicycle tour company, has been urging fellow cyclists and all who love the site to contact their congressional representatives and the Bureau of Land Management. Environmental groups have also joined this fight.
Thank you for these news items. Our first guest today is Chase Spaulding, director of the Bicycle Design and Fabrication Program at Minnesota State College Southeast, the only academically accredited program of its kind in the U.S. Chase brings to his work experience in welding, designing products, retail, and teaching industrial design. Good day, Chase Spaulding, and welcome to the show. It seems like our first guest is not there. So we'll go ahead with our second guest, who is Brian Hanold, and we'll try to get back to Chase Spaulding later. Brian, are you there?
I am.
Okay, good day, and thank you for agreeing to be on the show. Brian is Director of Aftermarket Engineering at the Trek Bicycle Corporation. How are things? I assume you're in Wisconsin now?
I am, yes.
And how are things over there? Snowy or?
Well, actually, we're having really nice weather for this time of year.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you for climate catastrophe and global warming.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Let's start with you, Brian. And before we get to your work at Trek, if you could tell us a little about yourself. How did you get into this particular field? Were you always a cyclist?
Sure. Well, I kind of ended up where I'm at by a set of circumstances that I would have never foreseen. I was an avid mountain biker when I was in college, and in a series of interns, I worked with some people who biked a lot outside of work, and I kind of got involved with that. And when I finished school, I actually went to work in the motorcycle industry, and I had a friend who at one point and took a job with Trek. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned one day, he said, if you're ever interested, look me up. He said, I think I can get you an interview. And things just kind of played out that way. And that was about a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I ended up leaving my job and joining. And I joined as an engineer in the mountain bike category. And I was developing primarily like aluminum full suspension bikes at that time. Since then, I've kind of transitioned it through a series of different roles here at Trek. And today, I am responsible for the engineering of Trek's products under the brand.
And your director of aftermarket engineering, what does that mean, aftermarket engineering?
Well, aftermarket, we, as the Bontrager brand, we develop a wide range of products. And part of that product goes our bikes that Trek sells, things like saddles and grips, wheels and tires. And there's a whole range of products that support the sport of cycling. It includes things like helmets and racks, fenders, pumps, water bottle cages, computers, lights. It's really a wide of products.
Well,
and those are the types of things that you find when you walk to your local bike shop up on the wall.
Yeah, and how hard is it to engineer those products? Is it difficult to make them? I mean, a light can kind of hopefully universally go on anything. But racks and fenders, sure. Are you specifically trying to design them to work with the Trek bicycles, or are they trying to work across the board?
Well, we try to make product, you know, the Bontrager brand, we have stuck with the Bontrager brand. It's a little more universal, you know, taking like a Trek brand product and putting it on another brand of bike. But we develop for our specific line. That's our main focus. But we also look at a wide range of other products in the market, because we want to be as universally applicable as possible. It's always a challenge, you know. At some point, you start compromises to be just, you know, way too universally adaptable. So, there's always some trade-offs. That
right, too good for everybody and not good for anybody.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we're also interested in hearing a little bit about how Trek develops an ideal for a particular bicycle model. How does that work? Are you involved with that process as much?
Not today, but I like I said, I'm in the bike categories. I'm quite familiar with that product development process. I did that for about 6 years, from when I first started. You know, a lot of it, we have an existing product line today. And so that provides kind of a framework from what we work from. And we'll look at that. You know, we have the bike categories. We're kind of split up around sort of use case for these platforms. So like we have like a city bike team and a mountain bike team, a road bike team. That are developing products for those.
Do you have a gravel bike team?
I kind of rolls up under one of the ways.
Okay.
But that's
just curious.
That's an interesting example. Yeah. Because, you know, end up with these kind of merge. And sometimes, you know, they're starting, whether it's like fat bike or gravel bike, a couple of more recent examples of that, you know, kind of a bit of a niche. They grow quickly, but you know, we'll work on of those 5-year boards that the product managers in those categories maintain, and always looking at, you know, what needs do our customers have, and how are we doing at meeting those needs, and you know. Usually, a platform, you know, may last for 2-3 years, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, before we'll go in and refresh the product to make sure that it's always, it's meeting the needs and it's kind of the trending in the market.
So and you're not necessarily ever building a bicycle from scratch. You're kind of tweaking it to where the market's at.
Yeah. Yeah, that sometimes we do. We end up with new platforms that come on board. And again, that kind of may derive out of just that market research. We spend a lot of time talking to customers and dealers. And that will have a way of sort of funneling into RNGX, where the team will be researching different things. And, sometimes that comes to a point where we realize that there's something you want to bring to market.
You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're here with Brian Hanel, Director of Aftermarket Engineering at Trek Bicycle Corporation, speaking to him a little bit about the engineering of how bikes and components come together and are developed.
And Brian, I'm interested in, is there attention paid for using eco-friendly materials? Are you aware of we all know that bicycles are, the best form of transportation, probably ecologically, but in addition to running, walking, and so forth. But is there attention paid for, the environment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's kind of a timely question for us. I think if you look at the bike industry as a whole, we've always looked at the product as being an alternative to the automobile as a means of transportation. There's some inherent green qualities to that, to be sure, and we've always been, I think, really optimistic about that aspect of it. But I think that, more recently, we've begun to focus on what we can do better in that regard. I think that, just kind of resting on the laurels of the product, just kind of green and inherently. We've become much more focused, and has kind of set a mandate for the company to become more sustainable. So we're looking at all sorts of different avenues, how we incorporate that or how we improve on that. So I think there's a lot of good things to come. We're still relatively early in that endeavor, but certainly I think over the next few years, a lot more from us in that regard.
So you've done a lot. How important are new materials and processes to Trek and how they develop things? So I know, when we made the shift to aluminum bikes, that was one big shift, then carbon. Now we're even stretching the limits of what aluminum and components can do. So can you talk a bit about what it's like when you've got some new technology coming in and how you start working with that, including it in your components and your bicycles?
Sure. We have a fairly robust R&D. It's part of what we do with the product development. And we're always looking at the material process. I think the thing, that may not be as directly seen by the consumer today, but kind of one of the things behind the scenes that companies are really learning a lot from is lies of rapid prototyping. It's really incredible what you do today, the materials that are to you, the speed of turnaround, those things. Like I was telling somebody yesterday, I'd given a talk to a group that was here, I see engineers be able to take a concept in the morning and CREAD models or tweak some CAD models and hand that off to our rapid prototype team here at and, you know, as soon as the following morning, they've got a part in hand that they can use to products that they're working on. So I think that's maybe a behind-the-scenes change that we've seen in the materials space that it's been really enhancing the product.
Has 3D printing affected that?
Yeah, for sure.
So being able to mock up an actual component in 24 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really incredible. You know, some of these materials, you can replicate the properties of, you know, like ones and rubbers and different things of that nature. It's really incredible. You can actually, you know, there was a time where I think you looked at that tech and you thought, well, you know, it's make a looks like what you're going for, but you could not use it in a testing atmosphere, let alone, you know, that be a viable means of manufacturing future. But we see that now is actually that's closer than it, I think. And so,
well, one of the fascinating things about bicycles is that the basic design has remained pretty much the same since the safety bike was born in the 1880s, and yet all these new materials and components are changing the bicycle, or at least its performance. I'm wondering what lies ahead, and is there a limit to what a bicycle might be able to do? For example, with speed, will we see something like Nike's new running shoe that gives the runners a little boost here, or maybe pedals that propel you forward? I mean, what are your thoughts on where the bicycle is actually heading?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I wish I had a crystal ball. you know, I see a lot of development happening today. They're, you know, looking how to marry the human body, the machine of the bicycle, to get the most performance out of there's some really interesting stuff there, and I think that, you know, the e-bike thing is really interesting thing to see evolve. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about that, I think something that's encouraging is what you're seeing that do for people and they're in getting cycling. I think people who maybe have some trouble with a knee and that's kind of been holding them getting out and getting engaged in cycling, and you know, the e-bike can help people in situations like that.
Yeah, for sure. So, I know a number of people who have some either disabilities or some medical issues that, you know, sometimes they have good days, sometimes they have bad days, and the e-bike has completely changed their ability to both ride for commuting, but also riding for fitness, because a lot of autoimmune stuff is actually made better by being active. But if you're too active, your autoimmune system starts acting up worse. And the e-bike kind of gives them the ability to adventure and balance and kind of get some of their life back.
Yeah, for sure. And do you know, even for just enjoyment, you know, people who are reluctant to go out and ride with friends, they've had some things that have held them back from being active, and they're worried about their fitness level and not being able to keep up. And that's kind of an impediment. And so, you know, it kind of helps reduce that barrier to entry. So, and a whole host of it, I think, are happening there.
And you have led Trek's design of the WaveCell helmets. What is unique about that helmet? On the web page of the company, I saw a company noting that we only have one brain. So,
right. And we did have the designers of the WaveCell technology on the show a few months back. So we know quite a bit about it, but can you kind of talk about how Trek harnessed that and put it into their own helmets.
Sure. And, you know, it's a great team out there in Portland. I mean, they're kind of right in your backyard.
Yes.
And I've been out there a number to meet with them as we were developing the product. I think a number of years, it was a national topic of discussion. You saw the stuff coming out of the sports industry, you know, with football and other contact sports, where we began to learn about what head injuries, the impact that those can have on a person, and it was kind of in that discussion that, you know, we took a harder look at the way we were developing product. I mean, we were always developing, you know, as a safety product, helmet always had to meet standards for the market that we were to sell in. And it's very tested, stringent fashion. And we were always very diligent with testing that product and making sure that it met the standards. It became clear that, you know, just designing to those standards, and then, you know, we developed products for athletes, so making sure that, you know, so that product was performing as expected, aerodynamics and that type of thing were drivers. We started to question whether or not, you know, we needed to reconsider what we were doing, and that led to a lot of academic research. There was a lot of emerging medical research on the subject, and the more we got it, the more we began to question the industry test standards. And that kind of took on this path that connected the folks at Waves and, you know, started the relationship that eventually led to the product that we launched last year.
You are listening to the Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBU studio in Portland, and we're speaking with Brian Hanel, Director of Aftermarket Engineering at the Trek Bicycle Company. Brian, we have only a few more minutes, so and you said you don't have a crystal ball today, or it's cloudy, but you know, the company started in 1975 with five workers. What lies ahead for the company and for you personally?
I think, you know, if you look at where we're at compared to, you know, even, you know, 15 years ago, there's been a lot of changes that have happened in the cycling industry. You know, the thing that really excites me is the product continues to evolve. I think there's some really great things, you know, in the sustainability realm for us in the future. Bikes play a big role, you know, looking ahead. I think they do solve problems. You know, our president, John Burke, talks about this a lot. You know, it solves a lot of problems, the traffic congestion, the fitness, the health aspect of it. I think that there's things that I see having a growing role in the future. Beyond that, it's just kind of fascinating to see the incremental changes that occur with each passing year. So, who knows? That's a good question, though.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Brian, and all the best to you and the company and other bicycle manufacturers as well. I hope I could say that. If you come to Portland, come and say hello. So all the best to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And in the second half of the hour, our guest will be Chase Spaulding, Director of the Bike Fabrication Program at Minnesota State College Southeast, And also, hopefully, we'll be able to get one of the students in the program and hear how that's been working for them.
We'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11:29 a.m. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studio in Portland, Oregon, and available also as a podcast. In the studio are Tori Bortman and Alon Raab, and our theme today is building bicycles. In the second half of the show, we're happy to have as our guest Chase Spaulding, who's the director of the Bike Fabrication Program at Minnesota State College Southeast, and hopefully also with one of the students in the program. Chase, are you there on the line?
Chase, do you have your radio on? Because we're getting bad feedback.
Is that better?
Oh,
yeah,
that's fantastic.
Better. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Is it still on? I think I think we got the echo gone now. Excellent.
Okay. Yeah. So Chase Spaulding, good day. And before we get to hear about the program you direct, which is the only program of its kind at the University College, you could actually get academic credit and a degree in bicycle building, which is great. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did bicycles become such an important part of your life and work?
Sure. So my background, my education, I went to design school and studied product design. So how do you go from a blank sheet of paper and an idea to the concept of a product or the testability of a product? And I went to undergrad and grad school for that with the intention of teaching. And then when I got out, this opportunity came up where it didn't just strictly apply my, you know, product design background, but it has parts of fabrication, which I've done. It has parts of engineering, which I have some very light experience in. And I was drawn to the concept of this program that was built before I was even in the door, was that they wanted to give someone these multiple hats to wear at one time. And it just really resonated. And at the same time, I'm personally more of a motorcycle dork than a bicycle dork. I love
but
both.
Still
equally,
bikes, but still bikes.
Exactly.
It's all bikes.
But I appreciated that it was education tied to something that you care about, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you're not just building something that a widget, you know, per chance, but it's a little
exactly.
more of something that you can actually be passionate about and see and feel the use difference. I mean, if you engineer a sprocket, or, you know, you're going to feel what that literally feels like, or even a bike frame.
Exactly.
And how did the program come about? Was it difficult to get funding from the school? Did anybody ask what's next, a program in developing a better mousetrap? How did you have to overcome any
sure.
opposition?
So initially, where this program was born was our dean of trade programs, Travis Thule, had wanted to introduce a new program at our campus. So we have a campus in Red Wing, Minnesota, as well as another in Winona. And he wanted a new trade program for Red Wing. And initially it started as just a welding program, right? It's a trade, it has lots of good paying jobs, it's a technical education, so it fit. But he didn't find interest from potential students, from industry in the area, or from the college. They said, we can get welding from anywhere. There's 100 schools that teach it. And so when Travis went back to the drawing board, he said, how do we do something like this, right? And just down the hall from us, our college has programs in guitar repair and guitar building, violin repair, and band instruments, so like winds repair. And so those programs work similarly, right? It's an object, a product that people get emotionally invested in and dedicate their lives to, and then we're teaching them a trade to go with that. So he basically templated our program off of that. How do we take a product that is a giant part of some people's life, it's their main passion, and how do we teach them a trade to go with that?
Excellent. And can you actually describe what the program is and what it looks like, how long it is, and what all is learned within that time?
So it's a 2-year associate's degree. Full-time, we're not, you know, large enough or established enough yet to have it broken into night classes like a lot of trade education is, but it's a 2-year full-time degree where basically we're trying to make jacks of all trade again. Education for the past 10, 15, 20 years has really tried to go towards specialization, right? You make the most specific worker, he can be the best one for a single job. And that's worked for a while, but it's sort of starting to bounce backwards, where now we have people getting educated in such specific fields that they get out of school and the job's not there anymore. Someone else took that one job or that one position. So we're kind of bouncing back to the other side and saying, how can we make one employee that gets to wear parts of these 3-4 hats in the product development process, in the manufacturing process? So these guys will come in and learn elements of design that you would normally have to go to a design school or an artistic program to get. They'll learn elements of engineering, principles, right? The foundation of what engineers know without having to go get a 4-year or a graduate degree in engineering. And then we sort of roll those two knowledge areas and practically apply them in fabrication and welding and machining. So they're getting pieces of all these educations, not in order to replace any one of those people. None of our graduates are going to become a company's sole engineer. None of them are going to be their sole product designer. But it's so that when they walk in the door, the companies that get our graduates get someone who can wear 2.5, 3.5 of these hats for one salary, which there are very few industry people who will say that's a bad thing to you today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's where all... even, you know, at many levels, that's where jobs are going, is that you need to be able to wear. Well, and I also love that the idea that they could, let's say someone takes your 2-year course and they're like, wow, engineering really did speak to me. I think I want to go get a full 4-year degree in engineering.
Exactly.
You know, it also gives them enough taste of multiple things, which I think a lot of times is lacking in university settings, that you're so on track for a certain very specific degree and maybe a minor, you know, or a second degree,
exactly,
that you don't get to know, to do any exploring in what you might actually really enjoy doing. Which, as we all know, all of us who've gone through life know, that changes.
Exactly.
It's not always
A lot of college doesn't work like a buffet. You can't take a free sample and see how it goes. You have to pay for that sample. And when it gets into $10, $12, $14, $20, $30,000 a year, that's a hefty thing to try out. So,
yes, that's a very expensive buffet. And,
exactly.
The program's web page notes that the design and fabrication of bicycles and their components is part engineering, part craft. Can you elaborate? Where does the craft part come? Where's the engineering?
Sure. So bicycles at their heart are a largely utilitarian device. If you can't sit down on it, pedal it, and move yourself with it, it's not an effective bicycle, 9 times out of 10. So there's inherently engineering that has to be done, right? A poorly engineered bike will make you work twice as hard for half the reward. So not to say you're doing, you know, differential equations and fluid dynamics to figure out the optimum bike, there's baseline things that must be checked mathematically and engineered, even just to size a bike to a user properly. So we'll walk them through a lot of those principles that say, not here's how you make the most ideal bike in the world, but here's how you avoid the simple mistakes, right? Here's how you save an engineer a few hours because you caught the mistake early. And then at the other end of that spectrum on the craft side, machinists are a very precise trade, right? It's driven by CAD and numbers and math, but there's a lot of the process of developing products and making new products that isn't so precise. There's prototyping and test models that often look horrible or are half completed because they serve different purposes in that grand scheme of getting something developed. So a lot of those techniques resemble crafts. They're using hand tools instead of power tools. They're using rudimentary processes instead of advanced digital processes because it's about time investment. Can they save an hour of machine setup and make something that will test the same way?
And is one of the students in the program available to speak? I know you mentioned that maybe Sean could answer a few questions.
Yes. Okay. We've got Sean right here if you'd like to speak.
Okay. Hi, Sean. And we're talking to Sean Haysman, a student in the program. Thank you for taking some time off from welding and fabricating. And whatever you say is confidential. The fact that your teacher is there would not affect your answers. Sean, what is your background? How did you come to be in this program?
So I spent 6 years working in specialty construction in oil fields and power plants. I've supported welders and supported machinists in the field.
Interesting.
So I kind of decided I wanted to advance that, so I looked for some sort of schooling that would advance that, and this kind of fit the bill.
And what do you hope to do with this degree once you get it? You said you're looking to advance that. So where are you looking to? What's your dream job after this?
I probably don't know if I have a real dream job. I know some that I've enjoyed before that I wouldn't mind pursuing more of would be like a quality control role in any type of manufacturing or construction field.
How have you found the program thus far? What has been most difficult? What has been easy for you?
So the most difficult part for me is that the rest of the students have had the passion for bicycles for decades, and I came into it not knowing much about bikes at all. So just trying to catch up in that base knowledge has been difficult. The more enjoyable parts has been getting to use different tools, you know, CNCs and mills and lathes and welding and 3D printing. That stuff isn't something that most people can just open the garage and use, so it's good to be able to use that.
And what does homework consist of, and exams? How are you graded? I mean, do you have to let the instructor ride your bicycle to see if it works, or what? How do those work in an academic setting?
Most of our projects, we don't show up in one day and build a bike. It's really making small parts of the bike. So we make our version of this part of the bike, and that gets graded.
Can you give me an example of something you've already made in your, I don't know, how far are you into the program?
So we're on our second semester, so there's not a lot that we've made so far.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want to push you too hard, because if you're just only one semester.
Yeah.
But what did you make already?
Right, So some examples of things that we made last semester, we didn't really make a lot of specifically bike parts last semester, but we made tools that we would need to make the bike, and it was convenient because not only did it mean we didn't have to buy that tool, but we also got to learn the experience on the machines while making those tools.
That sounds super cool. Actually, I am professionally. I teach bike mechanics, and I have been a bike mechanic. So that sounds like a really intriguing first semester of school. And then what is right. in the future of this semester? What's the projects that you're going to be working on?
So this semester, I think we are going to get to do a little bit of 3D printing. I'm not sure specifically what bike parts we're working on for that, but we're just kind of at the moment learning how 3D printers work.
And how has, you said you came in, I know because I teach a lot of new people, I also teach people how to ride bikes, that when people are first coming to bikes, it's really overwhelming. Sure. There's a lot of language. How do you feel your relationship, are you starting to feel more comfortable changing from when you walked in the door and was like, what, a derailleur, what, to now?
Absolutely. Yeah, the terminology that, you know, bicycle experts use is something I definitely wasn't familiar with. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on it now, but I'm much more comfortable talking to people, you know, about bikes. I can understand when they, some of the terminology they use, you know, whether they're talking, you know, top tube or whatever. At least I know what that is now.
Yeah, and do you have any more interest in actually riding bikes? You don't have to.
When I came into the program... Yeah, I don't own a bike, and when I came into the program, I probably hadn't ridden a bike since 1999.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't something that I was interested in at all. But just being around this group of people with the passion that they have, that is actually growing on me, where I've recently been considering getting a bike to go riding with them.
Yeah, well, and it's the middle of winter in Minnesota. This is not maybe the moment, but when spring comes around, something to consider. Yeah,
yeah, well, I mean, these guys are pretty crazy. They're still out riding their bikes.
Oh, I'm sure they are, but I wouldn't recommend starting there for you, because that's
sure.
That's, I mean, you could get that hardcore that fast, but that's a that's a lot.
Yeah,
well, Sean, thank you so much for your time, and all the best with the program. And please ride a bike sometime soon. And
I will do.
All right, thank you. And
thank you, Sean.
Yeah, we talked.
Thank you, guys.
We've been speaking with Sean Haseman, a student in the program at the Minnesota School. And back to you, Chase. So the students, when I visited your campus in October, you mentioned that mm-hmm. Thus far most of the students were men. Is there any, are there any plans to change that, to include women in the program? And why aren't there women in the program?
I'm sure women are welcome to the program, but is there any outreach that specifically
very much
happened
so.
For that? And are you doing...
To kind of To explain is... this first year of students was almost 100% word of mouth. We
okay.
didn't do any, I mean, this is the first year of our program. These guys are in their second semester, and
so,
they're the,
so
they're
this is the
prototypes.
Second semester of you teaching this program and running this program.
Exactly.
So this is,
so
we're still in practice.
So these guys are
working out
exactly. Yes. So these guys all largely came word of mouth, and cycling, at least in a very, you know, competitive sense, is typically more guys. Not by quite the landslide that we have in our building, but the loudest voices found it first, so to speak. But I know in terms of our next 18 students that are coming in next year, we already have quite a handful on the books, and I know there's a couple women in there. There's
Excellent.
Also a couple foreign students in there, one from Barcelona, one from India. And that's just what we have today. We still have the entire summer and this whole semester for more students to come and sign up. So I think as time passes and as we get to do more of, you know, the traditional recruiting a school does, going to visit high schools and actually see and meet students,
mm-hmm.
I think that number will skyrocket. We had one day where they brought several hundred middle schoolers to tour the college, and they were probably a 60-40 split of young girls and young boys. And initially, you know, some of the girls would walk in and they'd be like, ew, it's the boy room with the dirty tools and the loud machines. But very quickly watching and listening, and we let them, you know, weld and plasma cut and actually use some of our machines as little kids. Once they got to, you know, understand it, a lot of the girls were like, this is cool. So
because it is cool.
Time passes and we grow, it will even itself out a lot more.
Well, and can you tell us a little bit about Red Wing and the town and what it's like to live there? Because I'm assuming if you're getting international students and are attracting this program, since it is one of a kind, is going to attract people from around the country. What's it like to live in Red Wing?
So Red Wing is it's a lovely little, so I'm originally from the mountains of North Carolina.
Okay.
And it feels very similar. The mountains are a little less tall, but it's still right along the Mississippi with bluffs everywhere. There's lots of mountain biking trails for those inclined. There's also a fairly large, you know, road biking contingent when the weather cooperates for them. But it's a quiet little, I think, 16,000 some person town, home of, you know, Red Wing Shoe, also Rydell Skate. So it's a small town, but it has a lot of big things going for it. So it's not like you're going to school out in the boonies, if it strikes people that way. And as a sort of bonus, an hour away is the Twin Cities, which are as big a metropolitan area as anywhere else you'll find. So,
and has a huge cycling culture in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
And as a person who just spent a month at a residency next to Red Wing and rode every day along the Mississippi River, I could testify that it's a great place to ride, seeing lots of birds and foxes and so forth. It was pretty flat. The only time I actually encountered hills was when I rode to the college. But the town has a nice feel to it, and you know, seems progressive. So,
and is it right there on the? It's on the Mississippi, so it's right on the Wisconsin border.
Yeah, literally 5 seconds and you're across the border into Wisconsin. And
so how far are you from Madison?
Madison, I believe, is about 3.5 hours
away.
Okay,
so it's a little drive, but not in Midwestern standards, not that far.
Exactly, yes.
Does your program work with bicycle manufacturers? Can students get internships?
So our program was built. We had a committee that put together what they thought this program should be. So it wasn't, you know, wide-eyed, bushy-tailed me walking in saying what this was going to be. It was people from industry, from Trek, QBP Head, as well as from other manufacturing segments. So it wasn't strictly bicycle people. It was all of the interested parties.
And manufacturing segments?
We've got some people from 3M, retired engineers. We've got people from aerospace.
Wow.
And then people from just machining and manufacturing on the boots on the ground end.
Fantastic. So go ahead, as you were saying.
So they helped build the program. And the longer we've been here and the further we get, they're coming back and they're saying, so can we have some unprovoked. I'm not having to, you know, go out and beg them to take interns. They're coming to us asking for them.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, your program is a great petri dish for them to see, because the flexible and multi pronged person is who's really what the world is looking for now. So if they can find a great way to foster that, and I know in manufacturing, at least out here, we've got Chris King Components out here, which is a big bike part manufacturer. They have a very hard time finding people who have exactly the skills that you are talking about. Maybe they have them, but they don't know about bikes, or, you know, so your program is super exciting to me, because it's something I've heard throughout the bicycle manufacturing industry, but even outside of bicycle manufacturing, just manufacturing in general. If we want those jobs to come back to America, we need people who are multifaceted.
Yeah. No, our committee said they didn't reach their positions in their respective companies in a straight line. They said their history was checkered with a summer job here, an internship there, experience at this place. And they said without that winding road, they wouldn't have had all the skills they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is our collective attempt to make that a straighter line, a straighter path.
And Sean has mentioned that he's still not clear what he wants to do with the degree, but do you have a sense of what the students in the program want to do once they graduate? Do they want to work for small companies, big companies, or for themselves?
It is as varied as, the answer to that is as varied as the people are in the room. So one of my favorite things so far is our students aren't a stereotype. You walk in the room and see 18 completely different people for the most part. And because of it, they all get to learn how each of them makes different mistakes and how each of them has different strengths, but they also all have different interests. Some want to start their own companies or start their own businesses manufacturing parts. Some want to go and dream of the treks or the salsas or the Santa Cruzes.
Mm-hmm.
And some want to go work for, you know, a small company. They're like, I love what this company's doing. They're my dream company. So the answer is all across the board. And the nice part about the size and scale we're working at is we give them all of those different hats to wear, but they can tailor it a little to what they want to do. If you want to start your own business, we can focus more on that development of the products. If you want to work, let's say, in large machining operations, we can focus more on that. So they're not also going to leave 18 carbon copies of one another. They'll be able to tailor their education slightly to their desires.
Well, and I also love the idea of the cross-pollination of ideas of what's even possible. Somebody can come in and say, oh, I was thinking about, I want this degree because I want to go here. But then they might completely change course in a two-year time from something they heard from another student, got their idea.
Oh, I mean,
and that's amazing.
I mean, that Sean, who you heard from, his value is that he is not the lifelong bike fanatic that most of the other students are, is that he thinks differently than they do, and they all learn from it. And we have some students that are, we have two or three that are north of 60, and they think an entirely different way from the 17, 18, 19 year old students. So without that, without them sitting next to each other and hearing each other and understanding one another, they would miss out on a tremendous amount. So they're all helping teach each other as well.
That's great. I mean, that, and it's, that again is just going to end up with more well-rounded graduates, which is fantastic.
And Case, our time is almost up. We have a few minutes. I'm wondering, you know, how big a program do you want? I mean, do you want it to be a four-year program? Do you want other schools to have a similar program? What are some of your thoughts about the growth of the program?
Well, that's an excellent question. That's the million-dollar one. Right now, we take 18 students a year, and the program runs every fall. So students can start early and do gen eds, but if they want to start the program, they have to wait until whichever fall comes up. So hopefully we can grow to where we can offer that year round, or we can start to offer it in alternate delivery systems as sort of short term growth. Long term, though, we have, I imagine in short order, we will have other schools looking to do similar programs. And so maybe we work with them in some fashion. And as well, to the earlier point of, you know, taking this and translating it into, say, an engineering degree, there are programs that some colleges will set up where you can do what's called a 2 into 2 or a 2 into 3, where they could go here, take our degree 2 years at a low cost, you know, a community college, and then go to a 4-year college and receive credit for our program, and then take 2 or 3 years to get their bachelor's in something. So that's some of our longer term hopes, is to try and get to that point
for
where
those, maybe somebody
we
comes
can take
in,
what we have and grow it a little.
Yeah, and says, oh, I love that engineering. Now I want to go get a full degree, and they can carry that over. But I love that also they can graduate just alone with that associate's degree and go into the workforce. That's kind of, that doesn't always happen with associate's degrees anymore, and that's just so inspiring.
All right. Case Boulding, Director of the Bicycle Design and Fabrication Program at Minnesota State College Southeast. Thank you so much for your time and for this wonderful program, and we wish you and the students all the best.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
Hey, and you've been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. All our shows are available as podcasts on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb. I would like to thank our guests, Chase Boulding, Sean Haseman, and Brian Hanold, who have shed some light on the process of designing and building bicycles. Thank you also to our engineer, Ty Walker, and to my co-host, Tori Bortman. And I'd like to send a special greeting and hello to Sue Bichat, who's listening in London, and Gino Nugget Bartali, the little four-legged member of my family who always listens, and when I come back home after the show, greets me as if it was the best show in the world. So thank you, Gino, also. All the best to our listeners. Safe and joyful rides.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:59 a.m. Next up, stay tuned for Jazz Lives.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
This year, we're reporting out more data than we ever have reported before. And in addition to that, we have paper trails that we've never had before. And so we're going to take the time we need to verify these results, but these results are being based off what happened in the precincts last night.
Iowa Democratic Party Chair Troy Price addressed reporters ahead of yesterday's late release of some of the results from Monday night's long-awaited Iowa Democratic caucuses. The paper trail preference cards have to get into Des Moines from each of the state's 1,681 precincts, where party officials hand-verify the votes. The app couldn't handle the three sets of numbers, results of the first round of the caucuses, the second, and then how many delegates each candidate will get.
We're going to walk out of here with our share of delegates. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but we feel good about where we are.
All those who shared the most recent debate stage will get some delegates. With just over a third left of precincts to report, former Vice President Joe Biden was in fourth place behind former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, but that could all change. The Wisconsin Examiner's Ruth Conniff commented on the significance of Iowa's results.
There's only 41 delegates in Iowa, so it's not going to be a big deal as far as the actual delegate count for the candidates, but it creates an impression that can really drive momentum.
Votes or delegates. At one point in the count, Sanders led in votes and Buttigieg in state delegates.